Rated R. It contains violence, adult language, nudity, and adult content.
Alrighty, good evening everybody and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, July 21st, 2021. And thank you for joining us for the 113th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views on this show expressed are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. All right. Now, we want to have a topic-relevant bit of music that's played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that. And if you don't mind, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. So that was a song off Skid Row's debut recording called I Remember You, written by Rachel Bolan and Dave Sabo. And since we're going to be talking about remembrances and legacies this evening, I thought that would be kind of a nice intro tune.
That's excellent. Good. Thank you so much for that. As Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Remember Me, The Psychology of Legacy. I was trying really hard to find the song that had lyrics that reminded me of that stuff, and that's how we got the topic for tonight's show. And I did put a note in the script, and then I forgot all about it. It's a Rolling Stones song. And we're going to get to the actual topic in a moment. But before we do that, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So I thought we would do something a little different tonight. I've actually done kind of a similar trivia episode when I talked about flutes in rock music. That was probably a year or so ago. So tonight I thought I would talk about violins in rock music, not to be confused with violins on TV. Yeah, I don't know why these people object to violins on TV. Emily Lutella. And I got inspired to do that because, as you let me know earlier, Robbie Steinhardt, the longtime violinist and co-lead vocalist for Kansas, passed away recently. And so I wanted to kind of do a shout-out to him. And I thought that would be kind of a nice way to talk about his legacy. As most people know, Robbie was one of the original members of Kansas and played violin for them throughout the career that he was associated with them. Most notably, most people know his violin part in Gone with the Wind, Dust in the Wind, channeling my inner Atlanta mode this evening. But yeah, he played violin and a lot of their stuff. I mean, there's violin throughout their entire catalog. It's not just Dust in the Wind, but that's kind of the thing that everybody associates with them. But he is certainly not the only person who has featured a violin in a song or even a band that's had a regular violinist. So most people probably don't know that John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin, who is traditionally known as their bassist, is a very accomplished multi-instrumentalist who plays keyboards, but also plays mandolin and violin. And I don't know if the listeners know this or not, but a mandolin and a violin are tuned exactly the same. The only difference is one is picked with a pick, a plectrum, and the other one is bowed with a bow. But I can tell you, playing a mandolin, that playing a violin is a very different instrument. You really, the bow adds a level of complexity to it. At any rate, on their song Kashmir, John Paul Jones plays the violin parts on that. Now, when they would play live, he would do it using a mellotron, but he was the violin person in that song. So Stéphane Grappelli, who is known as the grandfather of jazz violin, was the violinist who played violin on the Pink Floyd song Wish You Were Here. In the original recording, his violin is mixed really down in the mix. Unless you've got like my kind of crazy ear and, you know, you're compulsive and stuff, you probably don't even notice. What's interesting is when they did the remastering of it and they re-released that, the violin comes up a lot. The violin part comes up a lot and you can really hear what he's doing in that. But that's who did the original violin part. There's a song by Skillet, which is kind of a Christian rock band. They have a song called Comatose that Jonathan Chu played violin on. John Mellencamp has a long time had a female violinist in his band, ever since probably mid-career, Lisa Germano. And she's the violinist that's associated with a song that everybody knows, Paper and Fire. And so if people know violin, a Mellencamp song with violin in it, she's the one playing Violin and Paper and Fire. But, you know, there's also a violin in Cherry Bomb and a lot of other John Mellencamp songs since he's gotten her. So that's the violin person there. Frank Zappa had a song out called Gumbo Variations where he had Sugarcane Harris playing violin, and Sugarcane is a mainstay African-American violinist who's played on just a buku stuff. I mean, the guy's just, I couldn't even begin to name all the stuff he's played on. It's mind-boggling. Dave Arbus, who is the one of the members of the group called East of Eden, is the violin part player on the famous Who song off Who's Next, Baba O'Reilly, that most people think is called Teenage Wasteland, but the title of the song is called Baba O'Reilly. And so the violin solo at the end of that was played by Dave Arbus. Now, when they play that live, Roger Daltrey, the lead vocalist, plays harmonica part in that, so the harmonica subs for the violin. But on the studio recording, it's Dave Arbus playing it. Sunday, Bloody Sunday, the U2 song. They got a violinist. Yeah, Steve Wickham, who played violin with them on that song. Milk Train by the Jefferson Airplane had another very famous kind of old school NOLA type violin player, Papa John Creech, who was a blues and rock violinist. He plays the violin on the Milk Train song. Do Ya by Electric Light Orchestra. Their regular member, because they had, you know, a whole string section. Their violinist that played off that and everything else they did was Michael Kaminsky. The song Hurricane that Bob Dylan wrote about the prize fighter who'd been unjustly jailed had hired a violinist to play on that recording, a Scarlett Rivera. So most people know that. It's a really long song. If you ever hear the original recording off the record, it's like 9 minutes, 10 minutes of an incredibly long song. Ocean Avenue, which is both an album and a song by a band called Yellow Card. They're a power pop punk band. I don't think they're in existence anymore, but they had their original members included a violinist who played on all their stuff, and his name was Sean Mackin. And he was their violinist for their entire career. And I actually just got turned on to them fairly recently and bought all their CDs, and I really liked their stuff. And finally, a song that most people may or may not know off Blind Faith's one and only studio recording by the album by the same name, which, of course, was the record that was done after Cream had broken up and Blind Faith had broken up. Traffic had broken up, and it was by the band Blind Faith. Traffic had broken up, and so Steve Winwood had contacted Eric Clapton, and then Ginger Baker heard about it, so he wanted to get in on the action, and then they hired a bass player from a British band called Family, Rick Gretsch, who was their bassist, but Rick Gretsch also played violin. So on the song Sea of Joy, on that recording, that's Rick Gretsch playing violin. And when they would play live, he would play violin live for them, and Steve Winwood would play bass on the keyboards. So there you have it. It's not as isolated as, oh, it's Robbie Steinhardt from Kansas, and he's the only violin player in a band. No. Survey says no. He's just probably the most well-known of the folks. But I suspect that our younger listeners who are more into power punk pop stuff would know Sean Mackin from Yellow Card for sure. Gotcha. And who freaks like myself would know Dave Arbus. And classic rockers like myself would know the Sea of Joy, because that's one of my favorite recordings of the Blind Faith record, which unfortunately only had one record and one tour. And on the hiatus between the tour, Clapton had already gone and started playing with Delaney and Bonnie, who were their opening act, and then left Delaney and Bonnie to form Derek and Dominoes, and the rest is kind of rock history. Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All right, Emily Latella, I got it. Cute. Okay. Again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call or come join us in the chat. The number is 914-338-0314. All right. So tonight's topic is Remember Me, the Psychology of Legacy. So tonight's show is about legacy and why some people are so driven to be in control of how they are remembered by others. I don't have a grand explanation about this. We'll get to that in the meat and potatoes of our discussion. But tonight we will basically discuss the definition of legacy. Why do we care what is our legacy, and demographics that affect legacy attitudes? And before we dive in, I'm going to check with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you want to bring up before we get started.
I want to bring up something kind of tangential, and I'm going to use this opportunity to do a shameless marketing ploy.
So your show, you can market whatever listeners, you want.
Watch out. Careful now. So if any of our listeners if any of our listeners want to be kind of a legacy, if nothing else, in their own minds, and want to live a long life in which they can help others and be a role model and perhaps, you know, affect other people in a really kind of cool way and be remembered by people in a cool way. Most of our listeners probably have heard me talk about this before, but the class has actually started that I'm doing on mental health nutrition. And so if any of the folks out there want to, you know, get in on that, I would encourage them to check out eCare Behavioral Institute online and talk to Acel, that's A-C-E-L. She's the person who's managing the class, and it's already started, but we're archiving them kind of like we do these radio shows, and they can do it after the fact if they want and get credit for it. So if anybody's interested in doing that and really living a long life where you will be remembered positively by your peer group, particularly if you're an inspiration for them to live healthier lives, I really, and I say this in all sincerity, I really hope that people will think about that and perhaps check out the eCare Behavioral Institute and perhaps give Acel a ringy dingy. So other than that, I'm good.
Oh, all righty. If I can beg a favor, if sometime after the show, if you could drop me a note in email with that information, I will be happy to put it up on our Facebook page so that people can go check it out later. It's a little bit too much for me to do while we're in a live show. Yeah, but I'll be happy to put it up. And that way, those
will,
of you who
what I'll do is I'll email you the site address and Acel's email address and her direct phone line, so people will have all kinds of ways to check into it.
Excellent. Yes, that would be very good. All righty. Hope some of you guys can take advantage of that. Yep. All righty. So let's go ahead and dive in. What is a legacy? With apologies to Hamilton, I'm sure Dr. Mathis doesn't watch that many Broadway musicals, but I, of course, am a Broadway junkie, and that's a major line in the musical Hamilton. So
I actually got that.
Oh, good. Okay, perfect. You know, there are lots and lots of songs about, you know, I'll remember you, or don't you forget about me, or, you know, remember me, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's a very, very popular and universal concept, which is why we're going to do this tonight. So let's begin our discussion by defining what exactly is legacy. This is likely to be a term that most people know, or at least know well enough, but let's just make sure we're all in basic agreement here. So I've got a short version and a long version. The long version is more clinical because that is kind of the work we're doing here tonight. So the short version is that a legacy is that for which a person is remembered by others. It does not necessarily mean remembered after you're dead. That's the most common definition, but it's not the only one. From there are expanded understandings, including by age, culture, relationships, accomplishments, and more. Sometimes the things we've done or people we have influenced that we hoped would be remembered fondly are not always the same answers that one gets from other people. You know, we've done a show before on unrequited friendships and that sort of thing, and also terror management theory, which is a little more worrying about your legacy from the standpoint of being in emergency mode, which is not what we're doing tonight, but it's a related topic that you can check out. But first, we're going to look at an in-depth analysis of legacy from a mental health professional in New York City. So the source for this and a large number of my notes tonight is a paper on psychologytoday.com, their website, by William S. Breitbart, MD, no relation to the idiot that's on that radio show that Caligula ran. Dr. Breitbart is chairman and the Jimmy C. Holland Chair in Psychiatric Oncology, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York City. Dr. Breitbart is also attending psychiatrist, palliative medicine service, Department of Medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and professor of clinical psychiatry at Weill Medical College of Cornell. He's got a lot of salad. All righty. And he says in his paper, we often use the term legacy to refer to what a person leaves behind, how a person will be remembered, and what they will be remembered for, parenthetically, good and bad. In other words, legacy that we leave behind. The term legacy and its clinical use in psychosocial interventions has not been widely adopted but in the palliative care literature until just recently. Perhaps because it is a complex concept. Dictionary definitions and the etymology of legacy are of limited help. Some root terms of legacy suggest that legacy is properly left by will or a gift left by will, as in like your last will and testament. That's what they mean by that. Pardon me. Other root terms of legacy suggest that legacy is derived from legate, implying a designated deputy, ambassador, envoy, or perhaps messenger. Examining these etymologic terms suggests to me, then that would be Dr. Breitbart, that legacy in fact plays the most vital of roles as a medium by which we transmit vital information, values, traditions, and wisdom to the next generation. Legacy is in fact spiritual and cultural DNA. Conceiving legacy as a mode of transmission of vital spiritual and cultural information and wisdom suggests that legacy is an ever-evolving continuum. There is thus legacy that we are given and receive from our ancestors, like grandparents, parents, and so forth, and legacy that we give to the next generation. The legacy that we are given shapes us in ways that are often apparent, sometimes less so, in how we live our lives. The values, virtues, traditions, and attitudes we either choose to adopt or reject. It helps shape who we become and what we become in life. Pardon me, I have the hiccups. For most of our patients, legacy is understood as what I leave behind after I die. Remember, he's an oncology doctor. Or how will I be remembered after I die? In meaning-centered psychotherapy, MCP, and this was mentioned by Breitbart and Papito in 2014 paper, we identify one of the sources of meaning in life as the historical sources of meaning. Meaning exists in a historical context, and so in MCP, the sessions on historical sources of meaning focus on legacy that has been given, legacy that one lives, and will give. In doing some 10 years worth of randomized clinical trials of MCP and treating scores of patients, several issues related to legacy as a tool for clinical intervention have become clearer to me. The concept that there is a legacy we are given is somewhat new to patients, but is understood and resonates quite clearly in an almost universal fashion. What became clear early on in MCP was that legacy wasn't always composed of noble, loving, wise, constructive elements. Sometimes a legacy given was an example of exactly how not to live one's life. Another perspective of legacies of loss and violence and abandonment was the concept of transcendence. We're all given a set of circumstances, genetics, environment, time, context, etc., that we are born with or into. The challenge in life thus becomes to live one's fullest potential and to perhaps even surpass or transcend the limitations of genetics, context, environment, etc. The notion of legacy as how will I be remembered or what will I leave behind after death is one that is most readily available to patients in the palliative care setting. What became challenging in MCP is the realization that some patients will say, I don't care if I'm remembered or not. And you see this outside the medical setting as well. There are people who just say this. The concept of the importance of being remembered is irrelevant to some patients. I remember the first time I heard such a response. I was a bit shocked, but perhaps the psychiatrist in me just didn't really believe it. I felt perhaps it was a defense against the fear or sadness that the patient felt that, in fact, they would not be remembered. After exploring this possibility, it was clear there were some who, in fact, felt that way, but others who really did not care, primarily because they felt they would never know if they were remembered or not, and because it was not an idea they wanted to be an influence on their freedom to live authentically. They objected to being judged, especially by others. Perhaps only their own judgment of how they lived their lives was the only judgment that mattered. In the course of conducting MCP clinical trials, it also became clear that there were patients who had no one to remember them. There was no one to leave their legacy to. There was no one who had been a witness to their lives and who would then survive them and thus remember them. What is clear is that we as human beings need to have our lives witnessed. Viktor Frankl wrote, quote, the only thing worse than suffering is suffering that goes unwitnessed, end quote. And it has a date since 1955 to 1986. I don't think that's birth and death. I'm not really clear what those dates correspond to. This need for our lives to be witnessed, I believe, is related to the concept of significance. The question of significance is an essential one. Did it matter that I lived? Did I leave some mark on this world? Did I have some impact on this world or on someone? Was there a sign that I was here? The idea of having a life witnessed relates to the question of whether someone else in this world noticed me and ultimately judged the value of my life. And that's the end of that section. Here is a second professional expanded take on legacy. And this is from a paper called What is the Meaning of Legacy by Michael Rucker. And this was November 2016. Michael Rucker is, in no particular order, author, father, husband, organizational psychologist and behavioral scientist, seeker, traveler, future astronaut, and more. He had like two more lines, but we were really trying to get a little crazy with that. And Michael says, this inherent drive to leave a legacy can manifest in a range of ways, from a desire to have children to wanting to lead a visionary movement that transforms a society. Although the manifestation of the process might differ between individuals, most of us seem to have a desire to create a legacy, to leave something behind when we go. Our desire for legacy can be biological, material, and or it can be expressed as our values and hard-won knowledge that we pass on to family and friends. And that's from a paper by Hunter and Rolls in 2005. Most of us, either explicit or unknowingly, have a desire for either symbolic or literal immortality, i.e., literal immortality, as some believe that there is an afterlife. This seems especially strong in those of us that understand death is inevitable, and that's from, I can't pronounce that, S-L-I-G-T-E, N-I-J-S-T-A-D, and these are last names of the individuals who worked on this paper. And the last one is DeDrew, D-E, space, capital D-R-E-U, and that was written in 2013. Our legacy, if adequately left, transcends the realm of our physical life and brings symbolic immortality. As our awareness of mortality grows, it brings into focus internal concerns and questions about why we exist. For many, this quest for purpose begins once we realize that the opportunity to leave our mark is finite. For others, this realization can lead fear, a threat to one's sense of self that we will likely soon be forgotten. And that is why I brought up earlier about terror management, because that is the beginning of that whole theory, if you guys go back and listen to that episode. Thus, people try to negotiate what we scientists call mortality salience in different ways. And the three names that I pronounce very badly again, S, N, and DeDrew, 2013, this is from a different part of that same paper. When reminded of our impending death, we often look for ways to transcend that feeling and employ different psychological mechanisms to reach symbolic immortality. For instance, we're compelled to connect with influential social groups because a group's existence generally transcends the existence of a single individual. Furthermore, groups also bolster our self-esteem and nurture our belief that the world meets the standards and values within our worldview, a rationalization that everything will end well. This has been a – oh, I forgot about this quote. Yes, this is literally in the paper. This has been explored in depth by terror management theory, or TMT, which was proposed by Jeff Greenberg, Todd Kaczynski, and Sheldon Solomon in 1986, and we did an episode of that last year. To quote, to create legacy, some of us, I fall into this category, turn to our creative side. By introducing new ideas, designs, novel products, and original solutions into our current reality, we possess the potential to influence societies and, dare I say, the world in a way that will outlive ourselves. Studies have shown that creativity is often used as a force of legacy, especially when the expression of creativity is socially valued. After all, we love our friends, our peers, our tribes, and most of us either explicitly or secretly want their recognition. Same three names I can't spell and pronounce, 2013. All right, that's the end of the contribution from that paper. And I also want to add that a legacy can be something one is becomes known for while still alive and here to be invested in. The main difference is that the latter is able to be amended if incomplete or not to one's liking. In our next section, let's talk a little bit more about why it seems to be so common that people spend a lot of emotional energy on their legacy. And with this, I'm going to pause and turn to you, Dr. Mathis.
It's an attempt to be immortal.
Yes, I took about 10 minutes to say pretty much that.
Which is a miracle because I'm not usually noted for my brevity. and that's being kind and generous.
I was going to say, we're having a little role reversal going on this evening. I'm not sure what's up with that.
Yeah, you got to change it up sometimes, right?
Yep.
The only difference is when you're alive, you get to enjoy it if it's a positive. Well, even if it's a negative legacy, if it's a negative legacy you want to be proud of, like you have the, you know, longest running serial killing spree, and that's something you want to be known for, you haven't been executed yet, you know, that could be a good thing for you, depending on how you look at it. But, you know, it's like if you look at the like the legacy that people like, you know, Eric Clapton has created, or, you know, any of the famous dancers or sculptors, you know, Nureyev or any of those folks, they were all famous in their lifetime, which is cool if you're wanting to be remembered and see kind of a form of symbolic immortality while you're still here to enjoy it.
Yeah. A lot of people don't get that. You know, they get their fame after the fact.
Yeah, I think that's actually more true than the live legacy, so to speak.
Yeah, that's probably true. All righty, so the next thing we want to talk about is, why do we care? What is our legacy? So now that we've established what is a legacy, let's talk about the motives behind it. Why are so many of us invested in leaving one or preserving those of certain beloved others? What about legacies that are not so great? What is our relationship with those? Let's look at some more professional takes on this aspect of the topic. We're going back to the Michael Rooker. Michael Rooker is actually an actor that was on The Walking Dead, and so I got used to saying it that way from the other show. I apologize. So The Meaning of Legacy by Michael Rooker. And he says, why do you want to leave a legacy? The crux of legacy is that we look for ways to be existentially reassured our life mattered. We bargain with death as we go through the psychological cycle of grieving our inevitable non-existence, from Ross, 1969. We want to leave a legacy because before we can psychologically accept the reality of our own physical annihilation, we put up one hell of a fight. Science suggests a desire to leave something behind when we pass naturally increases as we age. Newton, Herb, Pollock, and McAdams, 2013. I can pronounce those. Yay! Those of us that have long and productive careers seem to be challenged the most by the process of aging. And that was from Wexler and Long, 2009. Intuitively, this makes sense. If you worked hard all your life, inevitably making personal sacrifices along the way, you want to believe your life amounted to something in the eyes of others because you will not be around to tell your story. You want some recognition for living a dedicated life. Again, various studies suggest the closer to death we get, the more we crave this immortality. A study of women that were faced with a life-threatening illness showed that all subjects consciously started the process of legacy transmission. That was from Hunt, 2007, which could be interpreted that legacy closely links with our relationship to death and mortality. That sounds a little bit like something you just said, Dr. Mathis. Gosh. Many authors also think that the wish to create a legacy is connected both with generativity and narcissism. Newton, Herb, Pollock, and McAdams, 2013. Generativity is a psychological concept usually regarded as a positive one. Generativity often emerges in midlife and can be connected with parenthood or other social roles, such as mentoring. Erickson, 1974, defined it as the establishment, the guidance, and the enrichment of the living generation and the world it inherits. Erickson viewed it as a concept that is often focused on the next generation and an inherent individual care for its well-being. Narcissism, on the other hand, is usually viewed as a more negative concept, you think? Though there is a distinction between normal and pathological narcissism, I'm going to pause here. I did not make a note about this. Dr. Mathis, do you want to comment on this? You want me to wait until I finish the end of the paragraph there? Because
whichever you'd like.
I'm going to finish this paragraph, and then I would like to hear your thoughts about this normal narcissism versus pathological narcissism, because I can't think of anything that's positive about it, but maybe that's my layperson brain. So the rest of the sentence says, generativity is focused on others, while the concept of narcissism focuses on oneself. Therefore, we could conclude that wanting to leave a legacy on some level is associated with narcissism, since you do not need to be remembered to help society. It appears that legacy is likely a combination of both selflessness and narcissism. That's from Rubenstein, 1996. All right, now, I would like to see what you think about that point, because it's bugging me.
So what I would say is this. Think of it as, I actually prefer to think of it as egocentricity, in the sense that you're thinking about yourself, you're focusing on yourself in a selfish kind of way, but it's what it's taking the narcissistic drive that we have, that the desire to be all, you know, mine, and, you know, let me get mine and the heck with you and that kind of stuff, which is, you know, kind of part of our what I call the caveman brain, the amygdala hippocampus, the fight or flight survival brain. It's transforming those basic cavewoman, all or none thinking, good, bad, if I have it, you can't have it kind of thing. It's taking that and pushing it to the point where we want to be remembered so that we feel good about ourselves in a self-effacing kind of way. But you can, you know, it's overcoming the desire to be so selfish, if you will, that you don't give a flip about anybody else and you just want to destroy everybody else that gets in your way and steal what they have and take it for your own. And, you know, it's the Freudian term of id, you know, the immediate infantile primitive gratification thing. And so what they're referring to is basically overcoming the drive, the narcissistic drive, to be totally self-focused and transforming it and using it as a way, and as you use it to transform it in a way that helps not only yourself and other people, so that if you do things that help other people in a generative sort of way, which is what Erickson's talking about, in a generative sort of way, that you can be proactive and positive, help other people, but you're doing it for selfish reasons, if you will. But you're not being nasty about it. You're not, you know, hoarding resources. You're not doing it at the expense of other people. So it's kind of like taking a biological concept and transforming it, a biological drive, and transforming it into something positive. I will often talk to patients about three kinds of egocentricity and selfishness, because most people, you know, use the term selfish and they think, oh, that's a bad thing. And I'm thinking, well, the term selfish in and of itself literally means I'm going to focus on me, on the self, right? That's what it really means. There's no ethical or moral good, bad connotations with it. And what I talk about is you can be selfish in one of three ways. And, you know, this is what I've got so far. If I live long enough, maybe I'll come up with another one. But my just from observations, what I've noticed is people can be either very narcissistically selfish, so that they get what they want and they don't care who they hurt doing it, and they don't care if it inconveniences somebody else, and screw you if you starve to death, I got my meat and potatoes in front of me, right? And when you look at people who have narcissistic personality disorder, that's the kind of narcissistic self-focus they have. If you look at people who are what I call masochistically selfish, which almost seems like an oxymoron, but I see that a lot with what I call the Mediterranean mother syndrome. So, and my mother definitely had it. So what will happen is they'll put themselves out for their kids or their husband or their significant other or whatever, but they have a hidden agenda, and so they look like they're being almost masochistic. But what they really do is they have a hidden agenda. And the hidden agenda is what I call the Godfather principle. I'm going to call my marker in later. So I'm going to sacrifice myself on the altar of everybody's happiness for right now. And it looks like I'm being this selfless martyr. Oh, my God. But what I'm really doing is saving up my brown stamps. So as Eric Byrne of Transactional Analysis might say, I'm saving up my brown stamps so I can cash them in later. Hey, remember when I did X and Y and Z for you when you were 5 years old? Well, I need you to do this for me now. Gee, Mom, I really can't do that. That's that. You know, gosh, I just, you know, that doesn't fit into my schedule right now. I'm really sorry. I would have to. Well, when you were three, so now, you know, the godfather has come to collect his or her, or the godmother has come to collect his or her due when they put themselves out. And that's a form of selfishness, right, which is, and I call that masochistic selfishness. So the first two you definitely don't want to do. The third one I call self-enhanced selfishness, which, again, seems like an oxymoron, but it's really not. So the example I use a lot is because I do it, which is, as you know, I work 7 days a week, and I often will work on Sundays, and I'll often make house calls for people in need. And sometimes when I do, the people will say, gee, you know, we really appreciate it, you putting yourself out. You know, that was so nice of you. You're really a humanitarian. And I go, no, I'm really not a humanitarian. I'm really selfish. And they look at me like, what? Right? And I go, look, I took this job because I love what I do, because I want to see people be awesome and claim their power, and I get off on doing that. So there's a selfish motive there, okay, by definition, right? And so because of my selfishness and my desire to help people and my desire and me feel good about myself when I do that, right, I'm really doing it for me, which is the definition of selfishness, right? The good news is if I do it right, my selfishness helps you and me. It's a win-win for everybody. So if I feel good about doing my job, and part of what my definition of quote-unquote doing my job is showing up at my office on Sundays or coming to your house when you need me, it's a win-win for everybody. I'm helping you, and I'm helping gratify my selfishness. It's a win-win, yeah. And that's what I call self-enhanced selfishness. It's a form of selfishness that enhances the relationship. It's a form of selfishness in which every frickin' body wins. It's not narcissistic selfishness, and it's not masochistic selfishness. So that's kind of what they're talking about.
Okay. All right. That helps. I don't think
yeah,
they worded
it's not,
as well as
hey,
you
it's
did.
Good. It's not, hey, it's a form of narcissistic personality disorder.
Yeah, okay.
But if you think about it, and I joke about this, but if you think about it, think about what generativity is. So it's living beyond the time. You're generating a legacy for yourself in a sense. And it's generally considered a positive thing because you're doing things that are positively enhance your life, that are going to enhance other people's lives, right? But if you – let's say that you have somebody who is a serial killer or a serial rapist, and they're keeping track of their, you know, their notches on their, you know, their gun, so to speak, like you hear about the old gunfighters, right? They're being very generative. They're passing their legacy. They're creating a legacy for themselves by giving in to a negative narcissistic drive, a what I would call a bad narcissistic drive, right? A narcissistic sense of self, if you will. And like, well, I'm going to just leave this incredible legacy that I've created more mass murders than any person in American history. I'm the record holder, you know, like some Olympic athlete. Right? And that's a form of generativity. It's not very nice, but a lot of those folks are pretty daggum proud about it. And you kind of scratch your head and turn your head sideways like an English sheepdog and go, huh? But their brains are not wired the same way ours are, which is, you know, pretty obvious, I think. But that's a form of generativity to them. Their legacy is that they have the most guys or gals on their, you know, burial list, so to speak, or their rape list or their whatevers. Some of the people used to do, the bounty hunters used to do in the old South, where they would carry scalps on their belt to show how many Native Americans they'd killed. And they were like all proud of that.
Not that we're encouraging anything like that.
well, it's certainly not the kind of generativity I want to leave behind, but hey.
Nope.
What do I know?
Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and continue. I
sure.
found that very helpful in absorbing what they were getting at there, because I think you said some stuff that needed to be in there too. And,
well, that's
no,
cool.
That's better.
What I'm here for.
Yep. Okay, so the last thing that they said was, many people indeed associate a need for legacy with ego. Okay, good. So I cleaned it up a little bit in line with what you said.
Yep.
An active ego beyond death. In contrast, the desire to selflessly change the world is viewed as more altruistic in nature. Those that do things anonymously and do not wish to be recognized for it. Nonetheless, some point out that legacy has the potential to go beyond the ego and be weighted in altruism. It can surpass cultural constraints and become a broader aspect of human development that is a psychological driver of the greater good. And that's from Hunt, 2007. And separate point, and this is from Science and the Meaning of Legacy. One thing about the meaning of legacy that science seems to agree on is that the desire for legacy is somewhat universally seated in us. Since it is often connected with having children and passing either goods, values, knowledge, and or wisdom onto them, being childless can, in some people, create a feeling of despair and or sadness as they feel there are no outlets to leave a legacy. And that's from Rubenstein, 96. It was observed that some childless women look for other ways to meaningfully influence and support others, like family members or the community. Or alternatively, they wanted to create a legacy that is related to the whole human species. This desire can sometimes drive very old people to participate in, for example, anti-nuclear protests, even if building more nuclear power plants probably isn't going to influence them anymore. Some studies show that older people, it can be more important to pass on values and beliefs than material possessions. And that's from Hunter, 2007. It's clear that legacy means different things to different people, but that for most of us, it is the pursuit of symbolic immortality that drives us. And that is the end of that quote. Now, as for legacies we inherit that are not good or toxic in some way, that is a complex issue that is unlikely to be thoroughly explained tonight. So my best advice is that this is a mental health issue that one should take to a professional as soon in life as possible. And with that, I'm going to pause and check in with Dr. Mathis, and he may have some further suggestions, possibly, if you would, sir.
Yes, that's also tied a lot to the Adler concept of people being discouraged as opposed to people being bad or good or whatever. And he talks about if people can't get their needs met, you know, they'll choose negative ways or discouraged ways to do it, like revenge or undue attention or, you know, power over others versus power over self, which is kind of a way of leaving a legacy just in a negative sort of way, as opposed to being, you know, leaving a legacy in a positive way because you're getting your legacy, if you will, legacy needs met, your needs for mastery met by mastering yourself and by doing so, leaving a role model for other people and then helping other folks too. And that's one of the reasons I really like Adler. I love his theories. His stuff's really, really awesome. So our listeners who don't know about Alfred Adler, I really recommend that you check up on him. He had some great ideas about this.
Cool. All righty. Thank you very much for that. And
sure.
The last part that I want to talk about real quick is demographics that affect legacy attitudes. How much does one's age matter in terms of interest in legacy? There can be some differences in attitude between younger and older people. They talked a little bit about that in the last section. People who have some kind of warning that their time may soon be up, such as bad health symptoms. And, you know, these are just different demographics that might change your relationship with wanting a legacy or how urgent you are about it. How many wish list or bucket list items one may have accomplished. In other words, how many regrets of having done or not done things can affect one's attitude. The very young often do not truly have a complete or full concept of legacy because they're still forming their sense of self and identity in a way that affects how one wishes to be remembered. You know, there are some very young kids who have something profound to say about that, but an awful lot of them don't. There can be also differences when one is connected to others, which is an aspect that can change with age. Young adults up to the elderly tend to generally be the most connected to others. Younger people, you know, as in, you know, small children, are still forming lasting relationships. And those in the last years of their life have often lost many of those connections and feel lonely, which can affect one's attitude about legacy. And also, people lost suddenly at any age obviously have had no time to craft a legacy, but those left behind can be greatly affected by this sudden loss and devote themselves heavily to creating and maintaining the legacy of a lost loved one. And with that, I'm going to check in with you again, Dr. Mathis, for comments.
Yeah, that's why you see some people transforming their grief from losing a child, say, to a drunk driver, to getting the drunk driving laws increased in their area, or gun laws increased or whatever, or kidnapping laws or whatever. That's kind of one way that they deal with stuff. It's a more healthy way of dealing with grief than being miserable and bitter.
Yeah. A lot of people turn to advocacy as part of their legacy. So that way, you know, they've lost somebody, but they can be responsible for helping others not lose so many people the same way. Other than that, that is the end of that section. So we hope that our listeners now better understand the psychology of legacy and that we've empowered you to understand what drives most of us to live on through someone or something. And in short, as Dr. Mathis mentioned earlier, it's a form of that wish to be immortal, you know. None of us really want to go. There's a few people who do, but a lot of us would really like to live on and be remembered well and have people look back on the things we've accomplished and say how awesome they are. So this basically concludes our show on the psychology of legacy, and I'm going to check in one last time and see if there's anything else that you want to add about any point in the show.
All I would say is if you want to leave a cool legacy, start today, because the seeds that you sow today become your legacy next week, next year, in 10 years, in 100 years. And it can only get better over time if you start seeding them correctly. So never too
You're
early.
You're quoting Hamilton. Ha ha.
Yep, yep.
That is a line elsewhere in the show, and I had to throw that in. It's not classic rock, but it is a good point. You know, they talk about in the show, what is a legacy? Hamilton and George Washington are saying, you know, it's sowing the seeds of a tree that you won't ever get to sit under. And I think that may actually be a paraphrase of a biblical verse. I can't remember anymore.
Well, that would make two of us.
Yes. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, August 4th, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up over the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow night, Thursday Travelitch Radio, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Nothing pleases adventure travel writer Linda Ballou more than seeing gorgeous country from the back of a good horse. Her articles have appeared in Equus, Horse Illustrated, California Writing Magazine, and numerous travel publications. Lost Angel Walkabout is a collection of travel essays about her most meaningful adventures. Her new adult novel, The Cowgirl Jumped Over the Moon, travels from the Grand Prix jumping circuit to the High Sierras. Embrace of the Wild, her latest, was inspired by the life of equestrian explorer Isabella Bird, with an I, and covers territory that ranges from the life-affirming Hawaiian Islands to the majesty of the Rocky Mountains. How does a travel journalist translate her talents into the book-length form? Find out Thursday the 22nd when Linda joins Travelitch Radio for a half-hour discussion with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent Lee. On Saturday, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the 26th. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. Sunday, the 22nd of August, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, the Walking Dead online viewing party is on hiatus until then. Updates will be announced. There may be a show on the 15th, depending, because there's supposed to be some kind of prequel show, but we don't have details yet. But please join us on the air or online by phone for real-time discussions, updates, trivia, profiles on the cast and crew, and more. Monday at 10 p.m., Monday Night America, Roger D. Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. The Nightmare Hunter with Roger Noriega has moved to Tuesday evenings at 10 p.m. on Streamlabs. And Tuesdays at 10 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio is Fandom Access Week in Review. Join the terrific trio of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they dig into another night of TV. Please look for the Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, and iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. See you next time. And rock on. Good night.